Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals is provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information.
The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host.
All right, welcome back to the Cribsiders. I'm Chris the Chi-Man-Chu, and I'm with our showrunner and my co-host tonight, Dr. Sam Mazur. Say hi.
Hey. Hey, hey, hey.
And I also have our brand new minted producer, Vishak Venkataraman. I hope I pronounced that right. Did I do that?
100%.
Fantastic.
Yeah, perfect.
We have a fantastic guest tonight, Dr. Hannah Kepler. She's going to discuss Trisomy 21 in the primary care setting. But first, Sam's going to remind us what our show is about.
Oh, thanks, Chris. I'd be happy to. So we are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. We interview leading experts in the fields to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answering lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine.
We have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Kepler. Dr. Kepler is a general pediatrician in the Bronx. She's the associate program director for the Jacoby Medical Center Pediatric Residency Program, and she enjoys working with residents and medical students. She's also the co-director of the Family Weight Management Program at her institution and co-runs the Community Pediatrics Rotation for the residents. She is passionate about advocacy, community health, and medical ethics. In this episode, she teaches us what to look out for during the initial newborn evaluation of a baby with trisomy 21, the important screening tests and specialist care involved, and why we don't get routine screening x-rays for atlantoaxial instability.
Yeah, I think our listeners will really enjoy this one. Let's get into it. All right, so Dr. Hannah Kepler, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Because we're an informal group, I just want to first ask, is it okay if we call you by your first name?
Definitely.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Hannah, I really want our listening audience to really get to know you a little better. Could you describe yourself a little bit and maybe something outside of medicine that you do?
Yeah. So I am from New York originally. I went to medical school in the Bronx. I went out to the West Coast to do my residency and then came back to the Bronx, where I've been working in primary care pediatrics for the last 4 years. I'm also a mom to a one-year-old, and I have a dog and a cat.
Excellent. What are the names of your dogs and cat? Dog and cat?
Ah, the dog is Boba and the cat is Jasper.
Boba like as it. In like tea or Boba as in fet?
Both. Actually, his brother was Django, so they were Boba and Django. So it was like Boba Fett.
Wow. That's great.
It sounds like you're a true New Yorker having come right back to New York City. Is there any place, I know this is kind of off script for us, but is there any place that we should check out as far as food recommendations go? Because everyone wants a good New York food recommendation.
Oh, yeah. I love Shuka in the West Village for brunch. Right. I don't know if you've ever been there. They have really good shashuka.
I haven't. But Vishak, this is for you because you're already in New York and I just have to go very closely from Philadelphia. But this is what we got. I love it.
Is shashuka the tomato egg dish?
Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah, I think I've seen that on Instagram, so I'm hungry now.
Yeah, I got to check that place out.
Vishak, do you have any questions?
Yeah. So, I was just wondering, I'm in an audiobook sort of phase right now. So is there any book that you recommend any physician or anyone should read?
Yeah, I really like the book Mountains Beyond Mountains. I actually read it when I was in college and I ended up writing about it for my personal statement when I applied to medical school. It's about Paul Farmer and kind of his journey with Partners in Health. And it kind of inspired me to get into global health when I was in medical school. And I did 2 global health trips to Uganda throughout medical school. So that was a really good experience.
Sam, do you have any other questions?
Oh, Chris, I was going to say, I already asked a question. So isn't it your turn to ask a question?
Okay. One of my favorite questions is, I know you're an APD. You work with a lot of students and residents. So you're obviously an educator or mentor. What's some of the best advice you ever received as a learner or that you feel like you like to give to the people you are teaching?
Yeah. So one of my favorite preceptors when I was a resident taught me to always ask my patients how they do things and learn from them. And that really taught me that a lot of times our patients and their families could be the best teachers. So now if I ever hear something like, oh, I potty train my child or my baby's sleeping through the night, I always ask them how they did it.
That's fantastic.
I actually really love that. Yeah. Like, yeah. It's like who, you know, like there's no one who, for example, it's like, oh, you must learn from this person, but not someone else. Everyone has things to teach and we all can learn from everybody. We can always continuously learn. So I actually really love that as a statement too. And I'm going to use that going forward.
Yeah, me too.
I remember as a pediatric resident, that was before I had kids, I felt really weird doing a lot of some of the parental counseling when I was in clinic. But throughout my time in residency, I really felt like I did learn a lot from my patients. So yeah, that's fantastic advice.
Hey, Cribsiders listeners. Easy Resus is your ultimate support to take care of your sickest patients during resuscitation. Whether you are taking care of a newborn during a precipitous delivery, a septic child needing endotracheal intubation, or a seizing teenager, this offline app has drug dosing, equipment size calculation, treatment algorithms, all available in under 3 clicks. This gives you rapid access to life-saving critical info in a user-friendly interface, taking care of the logistics of resuscitation so you can take care of what really matters most. That's your patient. So for those who do not work with critically ill patients, that's okay. The app also has calculated doses of the most used PO medications, including antibiotics and analgesia. Although you can find critical first steps for basic and advanced life support, which could be useful for anyone anywhere. Finally, for those who also work with adults, there is a complete adult section with the same features as in pediatrics. So Easy Resus has drug dosing, the treatment algorithms, and equipment size dynamically calculated based on certain patient characteristics. It also has multiple alerts and content adjusted to age and weight to ensure safety. So someday you'll need to act outside your comfort zone, and with Easy Resus, you'll be absolutely ready. And for Cribsiders listeners, Easy Resus is offering you a deal. Listeners of the podcast get access to 2-month free trial with access to 100% of the app features. So here's how you do it. You download the Easy Resus app, that's spelled E-Z-R-E-S-U-S on the App Store or Google Play Store. Create your account, then use the promo code Cribsiders. That's code Cribsiders on the Easy Resus app. And for more information, you can visit easyresus.com/Cribsiders. I think we should leave it with that, yeah. Chris. Leave on a high note there and move right directly to a case. So, Vishak, would you mind kind of getting us started as we talk about trisomy 21?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, here's the case from Cashlack Children's. You are currently working in the newborn nursery and are seeing a new patient, baby Ty. Prenatal testing was done, which confirmed diagnosis of trisomy 21. There were no complications during the delivery. Your initial exam was done, and Ty was noted to have a poor motor reflex, and a murmur was heard. So just to start off as a basis, what is trisomy 21, and what is it characterized by?
So trisomy 21 is a genetic disorder that's characterized by 3 copies of chromosome 21. It's actually the most common chromosome abnormality that we see in live-born infants. It includes a wide range of medical conditions such as thyroid disease, gastrointestinal atresias, cardiac disease, hearing loss, etc., and then varying degrees of cognitive impairment. And the impact of trisomy 21 is really different for everyone. We can see some adults being more profoundly impacted and then some living independently in the community. So there's a huge range.
So we're definitely going to talk about all these components of trisomy 21. But before we kind of get there, let's go a little bit into the genetics, if it's okay with you. Can you tell us a little bit about what, you know, a trisomy means?
Yeah, so in most cases of trisomy 21, it occurs from just there being sporadically 3 copies of chromosome 21, which is non-familial, so there's that extra free copy. In 3-4% of people, we can actually see it from an unbalanced translocation from chromosome 21 in another chromosome. And the important thing to know about that is that 3/4 of them are de novo, but about 1/4 can be inherited from a parent. So in these cases, you would want to consider offering the parents a karyotype as well. And then the remaining 1-2% can be from mosaicism, which we can actually see those cases sometimes being more mildly affected.
Now, you said something about offering karyotypes and stuff. Can you explain a little bit about these types of tests that we're looking at, especially for the patient, the kid that we're seeing, mm-hmm. as well as the parents?
Yeah, so kind of the gold standard would be the karyotype that's looking at all the chromosomes. I think in the case of it being possibly familial, if the parents, you know, if the family were planning on having another child or wanted to know that if they were having another child, what would the risk be? That would be when you'd want to do the parental karyotype as well.
And so during prenatal testing, can you explain exactly what that entails?
Yeah, definitely. So basically, it starts with the screening. So ACOG, or the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, recommends that all pregnant women be offered screening for Down syndrome. And basically, the newer test, and the one that's now we're seeing a lot more frequently, is the NIPT, or the non-invasive prenatal testing, which is just a blood sample from the mother's blood. And it can be done as early as 9 to 10 weeks. So early in that first trimester. It's very sensitive and specific, much more sensitive than the prior, like, first or second trimester screens that we used to see. But it's still not diagnostic. So a positive result would need a confirmatory test, which would be either the amniocentesis or the chorionic villus sampling.
During counseling, are there specific types of women that they will be counseled that they may consider doing testing for trisomy 21? They would be more encouraged to do the type of testing, or higher risk?
So I think now they're calling advanced maternal age of women that are 35 and older. It would be, you know, more recommended. But like I said, they do recommend offering it to anybody.
The advanced maternal age, 35 and older, the harshest thing in medicine, as people often say. So this is great. So when we talk about prenatal screening, just to kind of summarize, it sounds like 9 to 10 weeks, we can get the non-invasive testing, which is essentially looking for any sort of copies in the DNA. That would lead to confirmatory testing that we sent, which we did do for our baby Ty. And Ty came out with a diagnosis of trisomy 21. And then we started talking a little bit about the exam. When Vishak was reading the case, he was saying that there was a poor motor reflex and a murmur was heard. So what are the initial exam findings you generally see in a neonate with trisomy 21? And we'll start with that.
Yeah, so one thing that is very common in the neonatal period would be hypotonia, and you might notice that poor motor reflex as well. There's the distinctive facial features that I think we're all familiar with. So the small head, the epicanthal folds, flat nasal bridge, upslanting palpebral fissures, small mouth, small ears, excessive skin at the nape of the neck, and a narrow palate. We could also see, you know, changes in the extremities. So that single transverse palmar crease, or the simian crease, the short fifth finger with clinodactyly, the wide spacing between the first and second toes with that deep plantar groove, and then the short broad hands. We could also see brush field spots on the eye, which are those white, gray, or brown spots around the periphery of the iris. We can often see cutis mammarata, which is that kind of fishnet stocking-like blotches to the skin. And then something that we might see in the eye as well could be a cataract, which is why you'd want to evaluate for that red reflex.
So one question I have is, you were saying before that the prenatal testing is offered, but mm-hmm. not always done. Mm-hmm. So I assume that also means that sometimes you may see a child for the first time, either at birth or maybe at their first appointment, especially if you were saying that the spectrum that you can see the presence of trisomy 21, it may not be always as obvious. What do you do when you come across a case where you suspect that maybe a child has trisomy 21 but has not had any prenatal testing or screening? What are your next steps? And actually, how would you discuss that with a patient or a parent?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I would say I would ask the family more about their prenatal care. Did they have any testing done? Did they see anything on the ultrasounds? Because often with trisomy 21, there are findings that you will see on the ultrasounds. They're not diagnostic. You know, like in the first or second trimester, they'll do the nuchal translucency screen. They may have seen, you know, a congenital heart defect or different changes to the bones or the brain or things like that. So I would definitely want to know more about that, more about the mother's risk factor, age, things like that. And then I think I would just be honest and just tell the parent, you know, this is something that I'm noticing. Would you be okay if we did a blood test on your baby, and then talk about getting the karyotype?
So You know, you did mention some of the initial findings that you see in a neonate with trisomy 21. So what are some findings that would require further or more emergent evaluation or maybe even transfer to the NICU?
Yeah, so I would say the same thing that we would transfer any baby to the NICU for in that neonatal period. So given the risk of congenital heart disease, you know, any signs of hypoxia, signs of heart failure, clinical instability, respiratory distress, things like that, you know, any concerns for any kind of intestinal atresia, Hirschsprung's disease, anal atresia, not passing meconium, bilious emesis, things like that, definitely, or a significant feeding problem that you're noticing right away, or significant apnea, bradycardia, or desaturation episodes, definitely.
And with the kind of hypotonia, I feel like that's one of the ones that is really going to come across as maybe being borderline regarding transfer and things like that. Do you notice that a lot of these kids come out and require respiratory support off the bat, or do they still do okay?
Good question. I mean, I think enough of them definitely go to the nursery. I've, you know, seen and heard about a good amount of babies that go through the newborn nursery, are discharged, you know, as long as they're showing that they're able to feed and gain weight in those first few weeks, they wouldn't necessarily need to go to the NICU.
So let's say they do great in the newborn nursery. You know, you've made that diagnosis, as you said. Vishak, I was wondering if you can like keep moving us through the case here and say that we've discharged and we've kind of, we're ending up now in clinic.
Yeah. So, you know, Ty's been feeding well, and then the weight has been trending appropriately. So is discharged from the nursery. And so now they're coming to see you in their first newborn visit. How would you go about evaluating them during this first visit? And what would you kind of look for?
Yeah. So I think the first thing that I would think about would be the risk for heart disease. So about half of children with Down syndrome have some kind of congenital heart disease. And the most common is a complete AV septal defect, followed by VSD, then ASD, then a few other less common ones. And then a quarter of babies can actually have more than one congenital heart defect as well. So it's really important to get an echo done, usually in the nursery, that's read by a pediatric cardiologist, regardless of whether a prenatal echo was done. So probably one of the first things I would do would be review the echo results, make sure that it was done and that it was read, and whether or not the child has any heart disease. If they did have a heart defect, you know, something really important would be evaluating for signs of heart failure and growth. And if it was something that needed surgery, kind of monitoring for that ongoing nutrition, weight gain, working with the cardiology team, looking for signs of heart failure, things like that.
Awesome. So we're really getting into these, to the kind of the first stages, and it sounds like the heart is the first thing to look at. We get an echocardiogram and say we have a small ASD in this patient, you know, just because they made it out of the newborn nursery and it didn't have a inflored heart failure. And so this one had to have been pretty benign on that case. Can you kind of walk us through what our guideline recommendations are for kind of the big evaluation, you know, kind of the big topics of evaluation? You know, it sounds like this is a multi-system disease process. And so therefore, let's kind of talk about each of those diseases individually.
Sure. So the next thing that I would look for would be weight gain and feeding issues, which is very, very common, especially for newborns. Breastfeeding can be a big issue just based off of the anatomy of the baby's mouth, the tone, milk transfer, that type of thing. So if it was a mother that wanted to breastfeed, I think I would definitely have her be working very closely with the lactation consultant, and I would be monitoring that baby's weight very carefully, assessing milk transfer, assessing weight gain, and that type of thing. In general, we do see feeding problems very commonly, especially in babies. So I would be looking at growth and weight gain very closely, especially in the beginning. And we do have growth curves that are specific for children with Down syndrome. So I would be plotting my weight and like on those growth curves.
How does the growth curve for a child with Down syndrome look different from our normal growth curves that we use for our other children?
Yeah. So in the first year or two, children with Down syndrome are more likely to be underweight. And then by age 3 and 4, they're actually more likely to be obese. So they're kind of lower weight and then they catch up. And then short stature is very common as well. So they would take all those things into account.
Are there other major areas that you're making sure you're hitting in these first couple of assessments when you're seeing a child for the first time?
Yeah. So just to go off of the feeding issues, another problem that you can have from that would be kind of aspiration and problems with feed, dysphagia. So evaluating for signs of dysphagia, like, you know, coughing, choking with feeds, if the baby has significant hypotonia, poor tongue control, things like that, desaturation with feeds, poor weight gain, I would definitely be thinking about getting a feeding evaluation. And that could include video fluoroscopic swallow study as well, and working with a feeding specialist. Also, silent aspiration is really common too. So, you know, thinking about that, if the baby's having recurrent pneumonia or any signs of silent aspiration as well.
Are there any particular counseling tips that you give during your appointment outside of what a speech therapist or a lactation consultant may give, like in terms of propping the baby while feeding or any other things that you generally recommend just from a pediatrician standpoint as a rule of thumb or not?
I think it would depend on what was going on in terms of the baby's weight gain and whether they were breast or bottle feeding, but reflux is very common in these babies as well. So I think kind of the standard reflux precautions would be good here too.
And what about any other screenings that we should probably do on this first visit?
Yeah, so hearing loss and especially congenital hearing loss is very common in these babies. Hearing loss can actually affect up to 75% of individuals with Down syndrome. So I would definitely recommend reviewing the results of the newborn hearing screen. And then if that baby passed the newborn hearing screen, the recommendations are to rescreen at age 6 months. And then if they did not pass the newborn hearing screen, they would definitely need to be seen by an ENT. I would definitely also recommend an early intervention referral for any baby that did not pass the newborn hearing screen.
Gotcha. So if they fail the early newborn hearing screen, you would refer anyways, but still repeat their hearing screen at 6 months? Or would you wait until 6 months before you do any referrals?
If they pass the hearing screen?
No. So I think I was a little confused. So if they fail their newborn hearing screen, that's when you would do early referral.
Referral to pass, ENT.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. And if they pass, I would rescreen at 6 months.
Gotcha. Okay.
Just to say a little bit more about hearing, not as much in the newborn visit, but as the child gets older, you still want to think about hearing loss as a potential morbidity, even for those kids that pass the initial hearing screens. So middle ear disease is very common because of the anatomy, stenotic ear canals, and things like that. So it's really important to treat middle ear disease as soon as it happens and then follow that up with another hearing test. And the ear canals can be really difficult to visualize, and it can be difficult to see the tympanic membrane. So the recommendations are for ENTs to follow these babies if the tympanic membrane can't be visualized by the pediatrician.
Awesome. And to kind of continue with the HENT things, you know, about things that we can see, you know, you had mentioned earlier when the newborn phase, or at least when we were back in the newborn nursery, so to speak, about doing the red light reflex and looking for cataracts there. Do you also need to send people to ophthalmology to get a better evaluation there, or is it fine for the pediatrician to do their standard newborn exam?
Yes, they definitely need to go to ophthalmology. The reason for that is the risk of congenital cataracts is so high. It can occur in 5% of newborns, but also other visual problems are really common. So strabismus, the cataracts, nasal lacrimal duct disruption, refractive error, glaucoma, and nystagmus are also common. So the recommendation is that the baby be seen by the pediatric ophthalmologist within the first 6 months of life.
Awesome.
And I understand that, you know, congenital hypothyroidism is also common in these kids. So is there any studies or any initial blood tests that you get, or is a newborn screening test enough?
So it would depend on your state. So states where the newborn screen includes the TSH, that would be sufficient. But if your state newborn screening program only tests for free T4, then you would want to do a TSH as well. And then the recommendations are that to also repeat the TSH at 6 to 12 months and then annually after that, just because the risk of congenital hypothyroidism is so high.
Awesome. And then
are there any other endocrinological issues that we need to worry about at least at this age or?
Yeah. So the risk of type 1 diabetes is also more common than in the general population. So that's also something to keep an eye out for. The risk of celiacs as well, but that's more in the older children.
So kind of summarizing the, so this is the newborn visit, right? We took Ty out of the newborn nursery, did okay, did well enough to go home in a couple days, didn't really have any glucose problems, or if we did, didn't go to the NICU, you know, and then made it back. And so we made sure that we did is that we are going to do an echocardiogram if it wasn't done already. We are going to watch, certainly from a feeding perspective, watch our weight gain off the bat, probably frequent weight checks just in the first week of life and making sure that we can feed okay, you know, lactation, anything you need. If things are going a little bit funky, we're talking about SLP or speech and language pathology referral to make sure that we're actually feeding appropriately and not silently aspirating. We are rescreening for hearing no matter what. If you pass, you're still rescreening in 6 months, but if you fail, you're definitely getting an ENT referral right off the bat. And then we're sending people to ophthalmology and looking at our newborn screen. We're just talking right now again about the newborn period. Are there any other tests that you would do or send to cover for any of the other systems in the newborn period before we get later on in life?
Yes. So one other thing that's very important would be getting a CBC within the first 3 days to evaluate for TAM, which is transient abnormal myelopoiesis. This is really important because basically if the infant has TAM, they would be at increased risk for developing acute myeloblastic leukemia within the first couple years of life. So basically, the recommendation is to get a CBC with the differential by 3 days old. And if you saw blasts on that peripheral smear, that would be a sign of transient abnormal myelopoiesis, basically. You would want to refer urgently to pediatric hematologist oncologist if that was the case. Studies have shown that early treatment can improve outcomes. Depending on, you know, what's going on, they may kind of monitor and follow really closely versus there's some treatments that would be up to the specialist. But it's really important for the general pediatrician, I think, to know that any baby that has transient abnormal myelopoiesis is at a 30% risk for developing acute myeloid leukemia in the first 4 years of life and make sure that the caregivers know what to look for. And still to know too that even if the baby does not have TAM, they still have a higher lifetime risk of developing leukemia as well. So it's always important to make families aware of things to look out for, even with or without the TAM in the newborn period.
And just a clarifying question about that, is the risk that we're referring to with TAM specifically AML, or is it all leukemias, including ALL, which we find very common in these kids?
So for TAM, it's specifically AML. Gotcha. But children with Down syndrome also have a risk of developing ALL.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you.
As the weather cools down, I'm brewing more cups of tea and coffee these days. We tend to obsess over the quality of our tea or coffee beans, but water is the key ingredient and deserves equal, if not more, attention. But not to worry, AquaTrue has me covered and they are offering Cribsiders listeners a deal. So what is AquaTrue? It is the top water purifier around right now. AquaTrue purifies using a 4-stage reverse osmosis purification process to remove 15 times more contaminants than ordinary pitcher filters. And they have water purifiers to fit every type of home, from installation-free countertop purifiers to higher capacity undersink options. They even have a Wi-Fi connected purifier and mineral boost options. So it's the same technology used by all the major bottled water brands, but now it's available for your home and without the plastic waste. Just one set of filters from their classic purifier makes the equivalent of 4,500 bottles of water. Best of all, the water tastes fantastic. It even makes my coffee and tea taste so much better. So, Cribsiders listeners, AquaTrue is offering you all 20% off any AquaTrue purifier. Go to aquatrue.com. That's AquaTru.com and enter code HOME at checkout. That's 20% off any AquaTrue water purifier when you go to aquatrue.com and use code HOME. And if that wasn't enough, AquaTrue comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee and even makes a great gift.
Hannah, are there anything else as we wrap up this discussion about the children we see in sort of the newborn and baby period? Anything else you want to let our listeners know about? Any other nuances that they should know?
So in terms of hematologic things that you might see when you get that CBC, I think it's important to know that very commonly these babies can have neutropenia, thrombocytopenia, thrombocytosis. Also polycythemia is really common and that would need to be followed. And macrocytosis is really common too. So if you get a CBC, to look for TAM and then see some of these other abnormalities, that would be, you know, pretty commonly seen. Another thing that to look out for would be renal and urinary tract abnormalities. So we don't recommend screening for this, but if something was noted on the prenatal ultrasound, it would be important to follow up. So important to review mom's prenatal course. Another thing would be just kind of like your basic neurologic assessment, just keeping in mind that things like seizures and infantile spasms are more common. And then also that obstructive sleep apnea is much more common even in younger babies. So it's important to discuss the signs and symptoms of that with families, at least within the first 6 months.
Sorry, we keep going for kind of follow-up questions here on these awesome points that you bring up. From the obstructive sleep apnea perspective, is there any test that we should do for screening, or should we go basically on symptom management, which we do find very challenging in the infant age?
Yeah, so I wouldn't do any test in the newborn period. The recommendations are actually to get a polysomnogram in all children with Down syndrome around ages 3 or 4, just because obstructive sleep apnea is so, so common.
Perfect. And we'll talk about that when we move on to the case. Does anyone else have anything more for the infants? No. All right. So Vishak, can you take us, Ty's now a little bit older. Can you take us through the next phase of life?
Yep. So you've been following Ty pretty closely in clinic, and she's now 18 months old. She started walking without help, but has not had said her first words yet. She communicates primarily by crying. So just to start out, what are the specific developmental and behavioral concerns seen in patients with Down syndrome?
Yeah. So this type of developmental impairment is really common. We usually start to see developmental differences within the first year of life. On average, children with Down syndrome say their first word around 18 months. And then, you know, IQ, we see it kind of tend to decline within the first 10 years and then plateau during adolescence. So other kind of developmental and behavioral disorders that we very commonly see are autism, ADHD, and then other psychiatric issues like disruptive disorders, oppositional defiant disorders, conduct disorders. Those would all be important. With autism, often we find that the diagnosis can be delayed because it can be a little bit difficult in the setting of the known delays of Down syndrome. And autism can also look a little bit different in children with Down syndrome. So children can sometimes have better imitation, relating, receptive skills. So I think any suspicion for autism, you would want to refer to a developmental behavioral pediatrician. And the screening would be the same that we would do in any child. So the recommendation would be between 18 and 24 months and then refer to specialty evaluation as needed.
And by screening, you mean like using something like an MCHAT or similar?
Definitely. There are some tools for autism screening specifically for Down syndrome. Those haven't been studied in larger populations, though.
Just a shout out to our previous episode on autism if anyone wants to check that out to find out more about all our screening tests. All right, go back to our usual topic.
So getting these children who may have behavioral developmental concerns, early intervention, and this is an important thing to have done for them?
Oh, definitely. At least at our clinic, we would probably try to connect them with early intervention from birth.
And is there specific early intervention that we'll see trisomy 21 that's different than your otherwise usual state-based early intervention?
Not that I know of. I think, you know, because really all the treatment that they would get is really treating the symptoms. So speech delay, motor delay, you know, gross motor, fine motor, things like that. So it would be the same speech therapy, occupational therapy, et cetera. So it would be, you know, the same kind of process that any other child would go through.
And I think that sounds good as well, just to like get them right off the bat, especially because we often talk about, you know, you have to get them in before age three, for example. And if you know that your everything is going to be delayed anyways, you're kind of like, all right, it's been 18 months. You've only said, maybe you haven't said a word, but you're about to say a word. So that's okay. So maybe you don't have speech delay for trisomy 21. You kind of go back and forth. So it's good to just, hey, just get it in, get it early. Let's start as soon as possible and see if we can make a difference.
Definitely.
Do you know what type of studies or research there might be about, you know, racial and cultural inequalities may be seen, especially with screening and some of these services like early intervention? And if so, what are some things that we can do to help combat that?
Yeah, definitely. So we know that there are a lot of racial inequalities when it comes to children getting diagnosed with developmental delay and autism in general. We know that minority children are often diagnosed at a later age and with more severe symptoms, and they're also more likely to face disparities leading to getting diagnosed. For children with Down syndrome specifically, we know that they're less likely to have private insurance, less likely to have a medical home, and more likely to have unmet needs. Some of this is because they require more coordination of care and they often face greater disparities. We also know in regards to Down syndrome that the disparities that we see in the general population when it comes to the mortality differences are amplified. So one study found that the median age of death for Black people and people of other races with Down syndrome was significantly lower than for white people with Down syndrome.
I guess just having that knowledge and making sure that we keep that in mind as we evaluate our patients moving forward is probably at least one of the early ways we can at least try to combat that.
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of what we can do is just, like we said, connecting everybody to services right away and just supporting them, getting them into the medical home, and just whatever resources we can share with them. Depends on your state. You know, in New York, we have OPWDD, which is the Office for People with Disabilities, that would be a great thing to help connect people to get services at home, additional resources, things like that.
Hey, CryptSiders listeners, let's talk some more about Freed. Freed is an AI scribe that listens, transcribes, and writes medical documentation for you. So here's the backstory. Gabby, a family medicine physician, and Erez, a computer engineer, came up with Freed, a solution that could help alleviate the daily burden of overworked clinicians everywhere. And for Erez, selfishly, it could mean that he would spend more time with Gabby, who was spending nights, weekends, and holidays updating medical documentation. So what does Freed do? Freed turns clinicians' daily workflow into accurate documentation instantly. There's no training time, no onboarding, no extra mental burden. All the magic happens in just a few clicks, so clinicians can spend less energy on charting and more time on what they do best. Today, more than 4,000 clinicians and their spouses have fallen in love with Freed. So Freed is this AI scribe that makes charting go away, doing your soap notes for you. It is HIPAA compliant, takes 30 seconds to learn, and costs only $99 per month. But you can try Freed for free right now by going to freed.ai. That's freed.ai. And listeners of CribSiders can use code CRIB50 for $50 off their first month.
Great. So now moving on to, you know, we talked a lot about initial newborn screenings. So now for toddlers and school-age children, you know, what evaluations do you focus on, and what annual screenings need to be done as a sort of follow-up from initially in the newborn period?
Yep. So a lot of it is kind of continuing the same things that we were talking about. So in terms of hearing, you know, we discussed doing the newborn and then the 6 months. So for babies that pass those newborn hearing screens, the recommendations are to do the behavioral audiogram with the tympanometry every 6 months, starting at age one, until normal hearing levels can be established by ear-specific testing, which is usually around age four. And then they recommend behavioral audiograms be done annually after that.
What about some of our other tests? For starters, we had mentioned a fair amount of blood tests when we were talking about the infant.
Yeah, so in terms of blood work, you would want to continue getting your TSH at least yearly to screen for thyroid disease. We can see both hypo and hyperthyroidism with Down syndrome. Some patients with Down syndrome can end up having subclinical hypothyroidism, so an elevated TSH with a normal free T4, in those cases, what you would want to do is check for your antithyroid antibodies. And then if those are present, you would want to screen them more frequently, about every 6 months, because they would be at higher risk for developing hypothyroidism. We would also recommend doing a CBC with iron studies yearly, not because the risk of iron deficiency is greater, but because it can be missed due to kind of that relative macrocytosis. So the recommendations are to do the CBC with either a ferritin and a CRP or the serum iron and TIBC at least annually and starting at age one.
And you know, while we're still on the test perspective, mm-hmm. Before we switch to some of the other screenings, you had mentioned we weren't screening for renal disease and NUAs earlier in life. Are we still not screening for them now?
No.
Awesome. So just hematologic testing. It sounds like we are not going to do a BMP with this labs.
No, just the CBC with the iron studies and then the thyroid screening.
Amazing.
Speaking of some of the other things that we may look for, and we talked previously about looking at growth and feeding, especially in the newborn period, are we still doing the same sort of concerns as we watch our children grow in their young childhood and teenage years? Is it possible for their growth to fall off, or if they're on the curve, they're going to be doing just fine?
So like we talked about, usually what happens is children are underweight and then they kind of catch up, and the risk when they're older is actually obesity. So that would be something to definitely talk about and kind of do the same things that we would for any child with obesity. So think about screening for comorbidities, think about a nutrition referral, connecting them with resources, things like that, and still plotting the weight and the height on the Down syndrome specific growth charts. And then we also mentioned that short stature is really common. So I think that would be something that you would expect to see. Feeding problems can still, you know, persist into those later years. So it would still be important to ask about any symptoms of dysphagia during feeding. And then, you know, still think about doing that feeding evaluation if needed.
And is this the same age that we may also start worrying about something like celiac? And if so, like what would be sort of the red flags we have that we should be considering that as a possibility on our differential?
Yeah, so we don't recommend screening for celiacs with any lab work in asymptomatic children, but they do recommend reviewing for symptoms at each health supervision visit. So that would be like protracted constipation, diarrhea, failure to thrive, anemia, abdominal pain, things like that. And then if those symptoms are present, getting the TTG with the quantitative IgA.
Awesome. And then, you know, we kind of did talk about OSA a little bit mm-hmm. earlier about the screening. You had mentioned we're going to send someone for a sleep study. Again, is this based on symptoms? And if it is, at what age do we start really looking for it? Or what age do we order the sleep study, no matter what?
Yeah, so I would start asking about symptoms right away and make parents aware of it, and then screen for that sleep disorder breathing, getting your history starting from the beginning. And then if you haven't already done the sleep study, then the recommendation is to get it between ages 3 and 4 for all children.
That's perfect. That's literally the perfect answer. I love that. Go for it,
Chris. I do have one question to follow up on that is, so say you do, you've been screening, you think, okay, things are going mm-hmm. okay. We do a sleep study at 3 to 4. That ends up being normal. Mm-hmm. Is that something that can still develop later in life, like in their teenage years, especially when we're talking about, you know, our issues with elevated BMI in our patients mm-hmm. who are later in age?
Definitely, yes. So I would definitely ask about symptoms of obstructive sleep apnea, even if the initial sleep study was normal, especially if you're noticing that trend, like the increasing weight gain or things like that.
And that actually brings up a good point. I was thinking from a cardiac perspective as well. Mm-hmm. We talked a lot about congenital heart mm-hmm. disease, and usually, and the way things work is we should be able to see any congenital issue on echocardiogram mm-hmm. at birth, and then would follow it according to whatever the cardiologist had mentioned. if they went through surgery, et cetera. Are there any acquired cardiac diseases that we also need to screen for, even if they have a normal echo to begin with?
Yes. So you want to keep in mind that there is a higher risk for mitral valve prolapse and aortic regurgitation, more commonly in adolescents and young adults. So right now, there's no recommendation for getting an echo or anything like that. But I think just kind of with your history and physical, just to have that in mind.
So a good reason for us to really do good physical exam and documenting well if we didn't hear that murmur before and now there's a brand new one when they're like 16 or 17.
Definitely.
So speaking of like doing some of our other examination things, you know, we're listening to the heart, listening to lungs, all the other fun stuff that we always do for our annual exams and so forth. Can we talk a little bit more about vision screening? Because, you know, you were telling that there was a lot of stuff that can happen with cataracts. Is how do we follow up? Mm-hmm. Do we just continue to do our regular exams in clinic? Do we, you know, we'll do our regular visual exams, or is this someone that, are these patients people that we want to refer to an ophthalmologist early?
Yeah, so I would definitely refer within the first 6 months of life. And then at that point, if everything is normal, the recommendation is to refer annually if you're not able to do photo screening in your office, or if you do photo screening and it's abnormal after that initial opto visit.
And so I was curious, you know, we're talking about Ty right now at 18 months. 18 months, we have scheduled well child visits. Mm-hmm. So we already, you know, 12 months, 18 months, you know, 24. Once we get past 24 months, are we actually going to do more frequent visits? Like, are we seeing patients with trisomy 21 every 3 months regardless, or are we doing annual visits as we get older?
So I think it totally depends on the individual patient and what, you know, what else is going on. If you're getting your CBC, your thyroid, you're able to do all your referrals, the patient is totally plugged into services, the family is really on top of all the appointments, you may not need to see them that much more frequently, you know, definitely at least annually like you would for any other child. But if there are other comorbidities or risk factors, if the patient has obesity, you know, other things that you're wanting to monitor more closely, then you'd probably want to see them more closely. But again, I would focus on those specific things that are going on like you would for any other patient with that issue.
So say we have a child, you know, a later older child who has been doing well, we're plugged in with cardiology, we've been doing our regular screenings, and now we're just sort of on the regular pace of maybe annual physicals because things have been going well. Are there specific things that we're doing as pediatricians separately than we would for our other children, or are we pushing vaccines a little harder because of issues that we may have there, or are there other things that we may be adding for our patients with trisomy 21 that we're concerned about?
In terms of vaccines, I would say they should follow the same vaccine schedule that we all follow. If the patient has congenital heart disease, you might want to think about pushing that RSV vaccine in the newborn period now that we have that hopefully available. And if they have heart disease, they may be a candidate for that the second year as well, depending on the clinical picture. I would definitely, you know, recommend the yearly flu shot that we would for everyone, the COVID vaccine, same vaccine schedule. And then depending on comorbidity. So if they have asthma, they may need that, you know, an extra dose of the pneumococcal vaccine, et cetera, but depending on other comorbidities.
And that actually, your final comment on asthma, maybe just think of a question too. We kind of talked about lungs more in the OSA upper airway component. Are there any other organ systems that we should be worried about from a hypodevelopment standpoint that that are kids at a higher risk to developing some sort of disease process in that?
So from a neurologic perspective, I mentioned in the newborn period, the increased risk of infantile spasms and seizures, but there's also something that's called acute regression in Down syndrome that we can see as children get older. So it usually occurs in like late childhood, adolescence, or early adulthood, and you can see loss of skills, marked mood changes, or catatonia. And these patients should be referred to specialists right away. Some other things, so dermatologic problems are also really common. We can see folliculitis, very, very common palmoplantar hyperkeratosis, seborrheic dermatitis, things like that. So would want to consider treating those. If needed, refer to dermatology. And then dental issues as well are also very common. So you'd want to have them see the dentist every 6 months, like we'd recommend to any patient, but very important just because dental problems are so common in these patients.
Awesome. That's perfect.
Any other nuances in this age group before we get to our teenage years that you think our listeners should know about?
So I think starting from the beginning, it is important to counsel parents about the risk of atlantoaxial instability. In the little ones, they're probably not engaging in as many contact sports, but once they start hopping around, I probably recommend them not to go on a trampoline. And you just want to make parents aware of the signs and symptoms from an early age. And then if they're getting any procedures or surgeries done, just for the parents to be aware of anything, you know, that could be a risk if it involves like hyperflexion or hyperextension of the neck.
Awesome. And I'm sure we're going to get into that when we start talking about teenagers. Vishak, do you want to kind of take us into the teenage years for our patient here?
Yeah, let's do it. That was a great transition. So you're now seeing a new patient, a 13-year-old Allen Toe with a history of Down syndrome in clinic. They're interested in trying out for the basketball team and requires a physical for clearance for sports. There are no cardiac concerns and they're up to date with their medical appointments as well as screening. Are there any specific criteria that you need to focus on regarding clearance for sports for Allen initially to start out?
Yeah, so I would definitely recommend that the pediatrician should evaluate for any signs or symptoms of spinal cord injury, which could be from atlantoaxial instability. So those could be, you know, motor, loss of motor skills, loss of bowel or bladder control, neck pain, neck stiffness, etc. And I would recommend that screening be done at least once a year, and definitely prior to any sports. We recommend in general kind of avoiding those contact sports like football, gymnastics, things like that, and then avoiding trampolines as well. But we don't recommend any screening x-rays for people that are asymptomatic. So I would only get the x-rays if they're showing any of those symptoms.
All right. So as we continue to talk about, you know, clearance for sports, you know, our good, you know, our pediatrician friend, you know, the sports physical. Say we do have a patient with Down syndrome, but maybe they might have some cardiac concerns. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe they have a little ASD that doesn't need to be closed. Then we're just monitoring that. Is that something that would give us pause to clear them for sports? Is that something that you would have a good discussion with their cardiologist? What are we doing in these sorts of cases?
Yeah. I mean, I think I would treat it like I would treat any other child when I would be clearing them for sports. So, you know, reviewing the cardiology note, reaching out to their cardiologist if I had any questions of whether they could play sports or not. But usually something like that, like a minor ASD, probably wouldn't be an issue. And usually the cardiology notes are really thorough and they include whether the child has any sports restrictions and they tell the parents as well. But definitely something to think about.
And besides the high contact sports, you're obviously saying, you know, probably shouldn't do those. Are there any other general recommendations we might be giving to patients and their parents?
I mean, I think it's good for them to be active. And I think getting involved in any activity that they're interested in is great, especially because of the risk of obesity and things like that. But just in general, sports are great for kids. So I wouldn't necessarily dissuade them from doing sports other than those like really high contact, high risk ones.
Anything where you can end up on your head sounds like a bad idea, right?
Right.
And then everything else sounds pretty good.
Yes.
All right. So, you know, we've talked about a lot of systems, you know, the systems from age 18 months to age 13 are a lot of the same. The one thing that starts to change a little bit is our GU system in our puberty discussions. When we talk about puberty, what should we be expecting for patients with trisomy 21? And is there anything different than we would expect for patients without trisomy 21?
Yes. So for females, I think it's really important to talk to the family about, you know, menses and talk about if there are any symptoms with menses, et cetera, and treating those symptoms. Because sometimes, you know, the premenstrual syndrome or menses can be distressing to some patients. So kind of addressing those symptoms. It's also important to talk about the risk of becoming pregnant. So for females, there's about a 15 to 30% chance of becoming pregnant. And then of those, it's about a 50% risk to have a child with Down syndrome. And for males, they're basically considered to be infertile because of impaired spermatogenesis. But there are the rare cases of men with Down syndrome that have fathered children.
As we're looking at sort of this age group, are there any other things for me as a pediatrician, as I'm working with parents and the patients in their transition as well? Because, you know, as they get to their teenage years, I'm sure they may be looking at trying to do part-time jobs, trying to be more active, volunteering. What are some things that you would recommend as we prepare these patients for transition to adult care?
Yeah, so one thing is kind of transitioning the medical home from pediatrics to adult primary care. And every clinic is going to be a little bit different. But for us, that would mean gearing up the family, getting all of the records in place, having a really good summary of the patient's medical problems, subspecialist medications, that kind of thing. You could even do a warm handoff if that's something you're able to do. Important to discuss independent living opportunities, opportunities for further education, employment opportunities in the community, things like that. I think something else that's really important in the teenage years is talking to families about guardianship and just getting them prepared for that. And for the primary care doctor, that often is something that we can help with, and we often need to complete the paperwork for that. So it's just something to think about in advance.
And we'd love to talk a little bit more about the community, you know, and these patients and what their lives are like as they start to graduate out of school and get kind of more ingrained in the rest of the community.
I think it's really different for everyone, and it would depend on their support system, you know, their family structure, et cetera. But I think a lot of people can find jobs in the community and can be a wonderful part of their family and like live really great, fulfilling lives. You know, as they get older, it would be important to make them aware of kind of some of the adult morbidities that we see, like the increased risk for Alzheimer's and dementia. But that wouldn't really be as relevant in pediatrics.
Awesome. Well, as we sort of wind down to the end of our discussion, and I want to thank you so much for spending so much time with us tonight. I definitely learned a lot, and I'm sure our listeners have as well. Are there any other things you want to let our listeners know about in terms of taking care of their patients with Down syndrome before we get to our take-home points?
Yeah. So, I think that Down syndrome, it can affect many different organ systems, and that if we're seeing these babies in the NICU or the ICU, it's really important to be able to know what to look for in that immediate newborn period. And it's important to get these babies connected to early intervention and services as early as possible. And it's important to be familiar with all these things no matter what field everyone is in, because I'm sure most of us that work in healthcare will encounter patients with Down syndrome at some point.
Well, Hannah, I want to thank you so much for spending time with us tonight. I think our listening audience will really enjoy this. They'll get a lot out of this, and maybe we can get you back on the show again sometime for some other topic.
Thank you so much for having me.
This has been another episode of The Cribsiders.
It's for the kids! Woo!
Get show notes and sign up for our weekly Knowledge Food Formula Feeds newsletter on our website at www.thecribsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. Special thanks to our producers for this episode, Vishak Venk Ketaraman and Sydney Engel, and our wonderful social media team on Twitter and Instagram. I've been Sam Mazur.
I'm Vishak Venk Ketaraman.
And this has been Chris the Chew Manchu. Thank you and good night. And for those of you who've made it all the way to the end, here's the bonus of a poem written by AI. In this gentle space where warmth and light blend, a narrative of uniqueness begins to extend. Trisomy 21, a distinctive thread, weaves through the tapestry where we tread. Dear parent, come close, let's discuss and see a beautiful potential that can surely be. Your child adorned with an extra gleam carries a spark, a distinctive dream. From the earliest breath through assessments clear, we chart a course that cherishes dear. monitoring health and attentive eyes, supporting growth under open skies. A plan unfolds, rich and robust, filled with interventions that earn your trust. Therapies tailored to empower and boost, skills that blossom in joy profuse. Physical therapies to enhance their might, speech that unlocks new delights, occupational engagements that fine-tune skill, every achievement a heart-swelling thrill. Fear not, dear parent, for together we stride, with commitment and care forever our guide. Hand in hand with each step we take, celebrating each milestone, awake. In this realm of nurturing, love leads the way, illuminating paths, brightening each day. With hearts intertwined and science in hand, we journey together through this wondrous land. See you guys.